Welcome to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN 720, and we're here. We're going to start things off tonight with my good friend and my collaborator, the great photographer, the great rock and roll photographer, Paul Natkin. Paul, thanks for breaking away from the NCAA to come down here tonight.
No problem.
You're such a modest guy. You've been shooting pictures for such a long time here in Chicago, and right now I wanted to have you on the show because you got so much going on. You were telling me. What's this heating and cooling place you're involved in?
I'm not really involved. Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a new restaurant that actually just opened today. It's in the site of the former Wild Hare, just one block from Wrigley Field. And it's these two guys that came up with this idea of starting a rock and roll bar that also pays homage to motorcycle stuff. So they came to me and asked for a bunch of pictures, and I ended up selling them about 100 pictures, which they have framed all over the place in the club. They have a sign painted on the wall that said, "These pictures are from the collection of the legendary Paul Natkin." And I always thought you had to be dead before you were legendary.
It's better legendary than the late.
Yeah, right.
Now, I know your work. We did the thing at Elmhurst, but I mean, and I did a little research on this. Do they have the Mellencamp picture up there?
Yeah.
Tell the listeners the Mellencamp.
It happened right outside on Michigan Avenue, right outside this window. I was sent to photograph this guy named Johnny Cougar, who was staying at the Intercontinental Hotel next door, just north of here. And we walked out on the street, and he said, "Let's make this really fast." And I said, "Sure, no problem." And I picked up my camera, and he dove headfirst into a garbage can on Michigan Avenue, and it crashed to the ground. And I've got this picture of him laying on the ground with McDonald's wrappers all around his head and the garbage can laying on its side. And one of my favorite pictures happened right outside this window.
And that's at Heating and Cooling.
Among many others.
What are some of your other favorites? It's at Heating and Cooling, I should say, is at 3530 North Clark Street. I saw that they were involved with some other places that you and I have probably never been to. Pearl's Tavern.
Yeah, they have about five or six restaurants. There's a place called Hubbard Inn, which I've been to, which is pretty good. It's a place called Barn & Company, which is a barbecue place on Lincoln and Wrightwood.
Okay.
That's actually pretty good, too. So they got some good ideas.
So what are some of the other favorite pictures?
They just went down my list, and the one guy that owns the place is a really big music fan, so he just started with A and started scrolling down the list, and every time he found somebody he liked, it's everything from AC/DC to the Rolling Stones to Madonna, you name it, everybody. It has no rhyme or reason to it.
Do you think it'll be – are you going there after the Cubs game tomorrow night? Do you think it'll be a big baseball destination?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
The pizza is really good. I mean, you know, it's just a pizza place, but it's, you know, kind of a fancy. TVs everywhere, and they're going to have cover bands on the weekend, you know, that kind of thing. But I had a pizza with calamari on it that was really good last night. Yeah.
Okay. Now, for listeners who the first time getting introduced to you, tell us about your roots in Chicago photography and when it started.
I just wasted all this material outside in the green room, but I'll try to do it again. My father was a photographer when I was growing up. He's one of the people that started Ebony Magazine back 1950, and he got back into photography in the middle 70s, and he got a gig working for the Chicago Bulls basketball team. And so I asked him to take me with him because I wanted to get into basketball games for free and get the best seat in the house, which actually worked.
And what era was this again? This was the very beginning,
1975,
right?
76. Okay. Okay. It was the Tom Boerwinkle, Bob Love, Chet Walker, Norm Van Leer, Jerry Sloan era. And it extended through the Artis Gilmore era.
Look at all the fans you got out there, Paul.
Yeah, no, they're waving at me. They have no idea who I am, though. For about 8 years, I had a card in my wallet that let me park for free, get in for free, go up to the press box and have a very, very good hot meal. And then I would go out on the court. I'd get there early. I'd go out on the court, and I'd shoot baskets with Norm Van Leer and rebound for him while they were warming up. And, you know, it was pretty cool. Never figured out how to make money doing it. I just did it because it was kind of fun, and I was learning how to take pictures. And then one day I was was shooting a tennis match up at Northwestern. And I got done about 7 o'clock at night, and I got in my car and started the engine, and the radio was on, and they were talking about this concert that was happening 2 blocks from where I was parked. And it was this unknown woman blues guitar player by the name of Bonnie Raitt, who was playing at Conn Auditorium on right on Sheridan Road. So I figured I was able to talk my way into almost any sporting event in Chicago. Maybe I could talk my way into a concert, because I always love music. So I shut off the engine, got out, got my camera stuff, and I rehearsed a huge lie all the way over there, the 2 blocks over there, how I was working for Rolling Stone and supposed to have a pass waiting for me. And I walked in the backstage door, and there was a guard sitting there. And before I could tell my great lie, he looked up and he said, "Oh, you're with the press. Go in and do anything you want. Just don't get on stage." And that was the start of my music career. I figured if I could get into concerts for free, I was golden.
Was there anything you learned in shooting basketball that you were able to apply in the rock and roll venue?
Should we get philosophical here?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
there's this term in photography called the decisive moment, which is the important moment. So it's the basketball player at the height of his jump, just releasing the ball. It's a basketball player dunking. It's a tennis player hitting a backhand right as the ball leaves the racket. Or in the case of John McEnroe giving the finger to the ref. Or in the rock and roll, it's a guy jumping off of a drum riser, somebody singing their guts out into the microphone, you know, something like that. So it's all the same. It's just different lighting and more noise.
Now, well, some of these, Ed Paschke, you're going to have a retrospective at the Ed Paschke Arts Center starting on, is it May 1st?
May 1st.
May 1st.
It actually opens May 2nd to the public.
Now, Ed, we both know Ed. You probably know Ed a little better than I, but we sat with Ed at the old stadium up in the upper deck for Bulls games and stuff like that.
Ed was a really cool guy. He was totally into blues and basketball. And we just got to be friends. I got to be friends with his son, Mark,
right,
who at the time was like a teenager, who used to sneak into the Aragon and go and hang out with Metallica. So Mark, Ed died about 20 years ago, something like that. And Mark has been the executor of his estate ever since. And he has all the unsold paintings that Ed did. So about a year ago, Mark met a couple of people that are kind of, they run a not-for-profit that funds art projects. And they said, well, why don't we build a museum in honor of Ed? So they built this museum in Ed's old neighborhood, which is Jefferson Park.
I have 5415 West Higgins.
Yeah, it's a block north of the corner of Lawrence and Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're in the middle of a total blue-collar neighborhood, and you walk in the door and there's $3 million worth of original paintings hanging on the wall permanently. And then they have a second gallery downstairs that they're going to have a visiting artist every 2 months. And I'm up on May 1st.
I read in just on their website, you'll have more than 20 photographs?
Yeah,
about right?
A little, like 21 or 22.
And how were those selected? You mentioned the restaurant.
They said, here are the four walls, just fill them up. And I just picked, I picked people that I thought people would want to see pictures of. There's some really odd ones, there's a couple that if I don't put names on them, nobody will have any idea who they are. There's a picture of the lead singer of a band called Mana, who you probably don't even know who they are. They're the U2 of Mexico.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They come to Chicago and they sell out the Allstate Arena for 3 nights, and they sing totally in Spanish. The audience is totally Latin. But there was a moment during one of their shows where I looked up on stage and it was raining on stage, and I'm thinking, boy, that's a pretty good effect they have there. Couldn't possibly be raining. And then the lead singer reached his hand out, and all of a sudden there was water rolling down his arm. So that shot is in there. But there's, Keith Richards and Springsteen, and it's called Superstars, so it's all the Johnny Cash.
Is Cash?
Yeah.
Well, where did you shoot Cash at?
I think you were there.
Was it a farm aid?
No, it was at Holiday Star.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it the Highwayman tour?
No, it was just him. When he had the country band, and June was with them, and you introduced me to his manager, Lou Robin.
Oh, Lou Robin, yeah.
And I went down and shot pictures of him. That was one of the coolest things I've
ever
done.
What was he like?
It was great. Yeah. I could still be shooting him if he, you know, he didn't want to stop.
Who's been tough for you? How do you get through to somebody who doesn't want to be photographed?
All the new guys.
Yeah. Okay.
all the people that don't understand that it's important to be photographed for publicity and for history.
How has that changed? You and I have talked about this before, but how has that changed from when you got in the business to the way?
When I got in the business, being a photographer in the music business was kind of, you were in partnership with the bands, with the artists, because, you know, everybody's goal was to make them more famous. If they were more famous, they sold more records, they sold more concert tickets, I made money off of the pictures. And now in 2015, I'm the enemy. Their basic goal is to have me not shoot pictures of them.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to be back and talk about concert photography in line with that. Don't go away with the great Paul Natkin. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hochstromer here with the legendary rock photographer and more, soul food, Paul Natkin. So tell me what's going on with the three shots and you're out. We were talking during the break. I mean, I go to the Arcata Theater and I see these old acts. Like I saw Southside Johnny a couple of weeks ago, and I saw Burton Cummings. Burton Cummings is on stage saying, shoot as many photos as you want. Come on down. And, you know, so why are people so fussy these days?
Because he's old and he understands. He came up in the era where people allowed you to take pictures. Now it's all about controlling their image. And, you know, God forbid that somebody starts sweating. You know, I mean, there's no way they could allow anybody to take a picture when that happens. I was talking about this last night. I mean, I used to have total access to Ozzy Osbourne because I took a really famous picture of him. And his wife thinks I'm great. But the last couple times he came through town, she said, well, you know, I'm glad you came out and, you know, here's a big hug, but, you know, don't shoot more than the second song, because as soon as he starts sweating, he starts looking like he's 100 years old. And she was actually right. But, you know,
where are they afraid these photos are going to go if magazines are going away and newspapers are going away? I mean, I know there's websites and stuff.
Well, I'm actually a victim of my own success, because my photos are with Getty Images, which is a big stock photo agency, and they license 300 images a month to everything from AOL.com to Rolling Stone magazine and everything in between. And any photo that I take could go to any of those places, you know. And if somebody sees somebody sweat, it's a tragedy. Biblical proportions.
How many shows do you go to now to shoot? I mean,
I used to go, without exaggeration, I used to go out 5 nights a week, 52 weeks a year. And over the last 5 years, I go out maybe 3 times a month.
And who's good to work with? I mean, you've told me before. Are there some younger acts that are like totally hip to the old way of doing it?
Well, you know, like,
what was that a cappella group or whatever you were telling me? Or some group you were telling me
about? Maybe Straight No Chaser.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Yeah.
Yeah, except it's a nightmare trying to shoot 14 guys on stage and get them all in the picture. But actually, I shot a show last Sunday night that was one of the most pleasurable events that I've ever done in my life. And it was so great, it almost made me cry. It was Janice Ian and Tom Paxton.
Oh, really?
At the Old Town School of Folk Music. And both of them, I went to soundcheck, and Janice just said, hey, come on up on stage, let's talk. And she introduced me to Tom Paxton, who I'd never met before. And I did a photo shoot of the two of them together before the show. And then I shot anything I wanted from wherever I wanted and sent them the pictures. And I got a check today from Tom Paxton. And, you know, I mean, it's That was a really beautiful show.
I've wanted to have you on the show for a while, but I wanted to wait till we had all these things in your life that I'm so proud of you. You got so much going on.
Yeah.
But there was this article at the end of the last year by a gentleman named Chuck Yarbrough in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And he just goes, he doesn't understand what this is all about. He goes, what are you afraid of? Bootlegs? Newsflash. You're never going to do away with those. They're as much a part of the industry as tour buses and sound checks. Think of the Grateful Dead without them, for crying out loud. So in my mind, it's either ego or control issues. And both make for
It's both. But, you know, it's really kind of funny. Maybe I shouldn't out him, but my friend John Bream, who writes for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, went to review a Garth Brooks show a couple months ago at the Target Center in Minneapolis. And, of course, because he's the big-time reviewer from up there, they gave him seats in the fourth row. And they wouldn't allow a photographer from the paper to come to the show because God forbid that anybody should shoot pictures of Garth Brooks. But John sat in his seat and he shot the whole show with his iPhone, and they ran the photos in the paper.
Well, this guy, I just put away that article. He said he got hassled for taking notes with the light from his iPhone.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ushers came and told him to shut that off.
There was
off.
A legendary story last year. Prince played at City Winery, and there was a sign on the front door that said no cameras allowed. And he had these two guys working for him that should have both been playing for the Bears, two giant guys. And they actually picked people up bodily if they saw somebody with an iPhone in their hand, picked them up and carried them outside and deposited them on the sidewalk and said, you could go home. This is after people had, you know, like begged and borrowed to get tickets for the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like, God forbid that anybody shoots pictures of Prince.
I don't want to let you get out of here. You know, today's Muddy Waters' birthday.
Yeah.
So I wish we had more to talk about in the local scene. I said maybe they'll open up the house today. But tell me about this blues photographer. This is a great story. Your blues photographer of the year in Poland. How did this happen?
Well, I know this family from Poland that they publish a blues magazine, and they're really big fans. The father, when Poland was still a communist country, used to smuggle albums in from America. And they would tape them and pass them along to their friends. So everybody had Muddy Waters records and Rolling Stones records. And he started a blues magazine, and he, you know, comes to Chicago every year for the Blues Fest. And it's either him or him and his wife or him and one of his daughters, or sometimes just the two daughters come. And every year they have a reader's poll. And, you know, this is the second time that I've won the award for the best picture of the year. And it was a picture I took 20 years ago of John Lee Hooker.
Of John Lee Hooker.
And so they're flying me to Poland in a couple of weeks to go to a big awards ceremony. And we hang out and go to 14th century churches. And we, you know, they also book Chicago blues artists to come to Poland. So I'm sure they're going to have somebody there that we'll go and see. And it'll be fun.
Is there a blues scene there? I mean, are there clubs?
Yeah, yeah.
In Warsaw?
There are a bunch of musicians there that are good enough. Like, there are at least five or six musicians I saw last time I was there that if they moved to Chicago, they could be playing in Buddy Guy's band. That's how good they are.
And the blues scene here in Chicago, what's the difference between shooting blues? Are the blues artists a little better with all these rules than the rock artists?
Yeah, for the most part. But, you know, it's like we were talking during the break. I mean, nobody wants pictures. I mean, this is horrible to say, but nobody wants pictures of these people until they die.
Yeah, yeah.
And except for Buddy Guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Buddy lets anybody shoot whatever they want. You know, he doesn't understand why somebody should not be allowed to shoot.
And the other projects you're working on, what's it like to shoot soul food pictures as opposed to
the blue
okay.
Soul food doesn't talk back. And the chefs are usually pretty nice.
So was that a fun project for you? Well, again, yeah. Seriously, I mean, we were on the road together for that book. It'll be out in October. But was there something different about it for you besides being with me all the time?
Well, being with you was, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah.
It was okay.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was fun. It was certainly different than what I'm used to.
Yeah, good. Well, thanks for coming in. I know you can see the end of the game. And I'm going to see you at Heating and Cooling pretty soon, right? I'll buy you
we
pizza.
We should go over there. Yeah. Pizza's really good there.
I want to see how your photo's looking at.
Yeah, cool.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Paul.
All right.
We're going to take a break for the news, and we'll be back with some record store day talk after this.
Shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico. It's the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN with your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
We're time traveling there. Thank you, Dan. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I didn't remix that whole thing today for me to not play it tonight.
That's so welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal, and we're here with our friends Rick Wojcik from Dusty Groove and Val Camaletti from, am I saying that right?
I've known
you, that's right. From Valhalla in Oak Park, and I want to talk about Record Store Day. So tell us all what Record Store Day is, what it means, why is there a Record Store Day? You guys both have record stores.
Well, I think it's the greatest thing that's ever been invented. It's most more fun than I've had in the last 45 years in the record industry.
When did it start? I mean,
it started like, was it 6 years ago or 7 years ago?
Seven, yeah. This might be the seventh year.
And it's a day where recordstoreday.com, whoever that may be, I know a couple of first names, but I don't really know who they are.
You know, they came out of, one of the guys had a store in Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it's some other industry people. And, you know, the thing is, it came along at a wonderful time because we had most of the sort of first decade of the millennium was about the death of the record industry.
Right,
about
absolutely.
The death of, you know, people aren't buying anything. They're all downloading. They're all pirates. They're all criminals. And, you know, and people like us, you know, we know people are still buying records. There are still people out there who love it. There are still people who really need that sort of solid.
And who want to talk about music and who want to care about music, you know. So and so they started this thing. The first year was pretty rough because people didn't know what to expect. And people were thinking, well, all I have to do is they're going to put out this cool stuff and all I have to do is call and order it and they'll put it aside for you. What do you mean they won't put it aside for me?
And the first year, half the stuff didn't show up till July.
Yeah, right. It didn't show up and we didn't know what we were going to get and we didn't know what the rules were. But people fell into it pretty quickly and I know a lot of people might say, you know, well, why have this one day? Well, if you just spread this stuff out and put out stuff every once in a while, it would all be ordinary. You'd call and they'd order it for you and hold it aside for you, and then you'd come and get it, and it wouldn't be any fun at all. And this instead has become just a, now it can be a little crazy for some people, but I personally, and I don't know about you, Rick, but
we grew up in crazy. It's nice
it's
to see
wonderful.
Crazy again.
I mean, to see a line an hour before you open, a block and a half from your store.
That bums me out, though.
Let's step back just a little bit because I think, you know, Val's enthusiasm, you know, which is well placed. I mean, so, you know, what she's talking about is the record industry. You know, at some point decided to start, and this was when they were, you know, 7 years ago, they were like, oh, God, it's all, you know, nobody's going to buy anything. They started to put out these special things for this one day, the third Saturday in April.
Right.
And they said, well, we're going to make some special things. And it was very small at first. By the second year, it had doubled. By the third year, it had doubled after that. And what these are the kinds of things that, you know, Rolling Stones picture sleeve single. They haven't made those in 30 years, you know, or unreleased tapes of, you know, some great artist that you've never heard. You know, really special stuff. A lot of it is vinyl. It's very vinyl heavy. And I'm going to disagree with Val because I think it's a great day. But what I've also seen, you know, 6 years ago, I used to say, well, this is great. Give it to us all year long. Now they are. I mean, one of the things I've seen as a major trend is the success of this day, which has shown people we have people showing up at 2 or 3 in the morning,
right?
You know, and we got a 2 blocks line before we open at 8, you know, to buy this stuff, which is very limited. Now these labels are saying, wait a minute, there are customers. They've looked at these lines and said, hey, let's get these people in the store in, you know, March. Let's get them in the store in June.
To some extent, they do.
Yeah.
But it loses something if it's available, even cool stuff, if it's available all the time.
Right.
This and what we have, which just thrills me, is we have just really cool customers. They're very patient.
Yes.
They're generous. They, you know, they are willing to accept whatever rules we set for what you can buy and how many you can pick up and what you can do.
Which are usually set by the parent organization.
We have to sign more or less.
Sort of draconian pledge that says if we step out of line, we can never participate
again. A couple years ago for the Sun-Times, I did a story, and the guys at Numero Group got slapped on the hand by organization for doing a pop-up record store.
Yeah,
Record Store Day. How dare they do that?
Reality is that if you allow too much of that, I mean, we're already struck by the fact that, you know, an hour after you open, there's stuff on eBay
right.
for, you know, four times what yeah. the guy standing in line since 2 a.m. has yeah. been waiting for.
But, you know, he's probably the guy that bought it when you opened and went home and put it on eBay 45
sure.
minutes later. And that's, you know, that's something they can't stop.
Nobody could stop that. It's going to happen.
Records, you know.
It's going to happen. But it is fun, and I like to see that happen. And we also have, and I hope you have, and I hope a lot of stores have, the people who really come in just to celebrate their independent record store. They're not going to stand in line for the special stuff. They're just going to go, like, we put everything on sale that day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. yeah.
And they just come to say, it's record store day. We wanted to say hi, and we want to shop.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're open till 9, and we're kicking them out the door at 9.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we get a magician. We're getting out food.
You got
we're
the spinning wheel.
Doing all
I've
this
done
stuff.
That. Yeah.
You know, just it's crazy, but it's great. And people are bringing their kids. It's a little bit like church on Christmas and Easter.
That's
right. Where you get people.
And
you're going to say, like, hey, I'd love to see you every other Sunday, but, you know, you're happy they're there. You know?
Oh, yeah. I think it's great fun.
It's Saturday, April 18th.
2 weeks from tomorrow.
Yeah, and what time does it start for each of you?
Well, for us, it starts at 9, which is 2 hours earlier than we normally open. We normally open at 11. So we open at 9 with donuts and coffee for the early birds.
For us, it's 8. And although we're giving out bagels and donuts and coffee at about 6 in the morning.
And I'll have a proxy that can stand in line for me.
Yeah, you got one. That's cool.
They'll get your bagel, though. You better be careful.
What are some of the hot items this year? I've been glancing at the website this afternoon. I mean, there's some stuff like a stretch. I mean, I saw an AHA picture sleeve and stuff. Or You know,
I looked at 400 titles, and I can't remember one of them.
You know, I'm with you, because I've got my little cheat sheets in front of me here. But, you know, every year, to me, the best stuff is the kind of stuff that they're putting out now that, you know, you wish you had been alive in the 60s to buy. So you'll get, like, an Animals 10-inch, or you'll get a Jeff Beck picture sleeve.
Yeah, I saw that.
Or, you know, unreleased stuff, like the organist Larry Young, who we love. You know, they've got some unreleased stuff he did in Paris during the height of his career. Or there's, like, a rare Sun Ra live set that's never come out. You know, there's beautiful packages of vintage stuff. Like, they're doing the second box. They did one of these on Black Friday of Miles Davis, the original 10-inch LPs he did for Prestige Records, you know. You know, just really great. And to me, those are the highlights. There's a lot of people, and I'm sure you'll agree with me. Try to sneak things in.
So
you get about, you know, half of it is like, hey, you know, my brother recorded something. Let's pull it on record store day.
The other thing that's a little disturbing for me is there are some really outrageously high-priced stuff.
Yes.
And that can be a little disconcerting, you know, the $60 and $70 and $80 and $100 box sets.
Well, we just can't afford them because you can't return any of this stuff.
You can't return any of it.
So if they're charging you $200,
and
you know, you're not
going
to say
the one thing that makes it difficult at our end for record store day is we have to make this decision 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what's coming out. And so we have no way to gauge. It's always the thing that nobody is going to ask for this. Nobody's mentioned this band the entire year. So, nobody's going to, you know, those are the first 5 calls we're going to get is for that stuff. And it's going to be a box set that's $134.99.
Right.
And, you know, that's a little tough, but it's, and we know it's going to happen. We know people are going to try and jump on it. My favorite item was about 2 years ago was the Buck Owens coloring book.
I thought that was the best thing
they've ever put out.
Val, you opened in 1972.
I did.
And now at 239 Harrison, different location.
It was on South Boulevard in Oak Park, and it was the, I had already run a small five store chain in that same location from 67. So, but in 72 is when it became Val's Hollow.
And one reason I wanted to have you on the show is I know you've, it's 72, that's a long time to be.
That's a long, I'm really old.
I know 2012 they had that house party and stuff. So there's been ebbs and flows for you in the business.
I'll tell you, I've said this and I'll say it again and again and again.
Sue and Jim Gill, right?
Sue and Jim Gill.
Yeah.
And mostly vinyl. If this resurgence had not happened, I'm not sure I would still be there.
Interesting.
I mean, because the cost or the selling price of used CDs, which are a big thing still, not as big as they used to be, but they've dropped by half in terms of what you can sell them for. Because a lot of new CDs are only $5.99 and $6.99. So what are you going to sell a used one for? $2? And so there just wasn't enough cash turning over. So the vinyl resurgence. But yes, that jump in by friends to keep us going, to make it, to allow us to buy the vinyl we needed for the 2012 Christmas. That was the big deal.
The one thing I've heard, you know, and it's about whether it's a record store or a coffee shop or a restaurant. I mean, you have to make it like a cultural destination, a place where people – you touch on it, a place where people can gather and stuff, something they can't get online and stuff. Right. Can you talk about each of your places being
a
gathering place,
us.
A Dusty Groove? I always see – a lot of times I see people from out of the country in there. So tell me about it as a destination point and why that's important.
Well, that's – I mean – you know, I kid customers all the time since I want to do that sort of thing about the fact that, you know, somebody comes in the store, it's the first time and they live in Downers Grove or something. And I say, are you kidding me? We get people from South Africa. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me Downers Grove is too far for you to come to Oak Park. But that's part of it is that I had a guy in a few weeks ago, a few months ago, who said something about I could tell it was an English accent, and I asked him why he was there. Did he come for Frank Lloyd Wright or Hemingway or, you know, and he said, no, I come for here. And I said, well, here, you mean my store here? And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, how'd you find out about it? He said, I read about you in a book in England. Yeah. You know, I mean,
that old, rare, new, right? You got a good portrait in that book.
You get.
What book is that? I don't know.
It's a great book on used. It was a. She was kind of a doctorate student, right, in an English university.
Couple.
And she did this whole sort of blog series, but then she went around and interviewed all of these record store owners, both in England and America, and talked
about
to them.
Yeah, and I forgot the interview completely.
The book's
I
called
said,
Old Rare New. It's been out for, what, 7 years?
Oh,
or
it's
something.
Been out six
Beautiful
or seven
book.
Years. Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah. But that's part of it is the idea of create. And that when that happened in 2012 – my question was, why would anybody donate or come to this party or do any of those things? Businesses go out all the time. Mm-hmm. Why does anybody care? Mm-hmm. And what I found out was that it wasn't just about the business existing. It was a part of the community.
It is.
And that's a big part of it.
We're going to take a break for some spots. We'll be right back and talk more about Record Store Day, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. We're talking Record Store Day here. And Val, I didn't want to let you get out of here without talking about your life at Capitol Records. So we wanted to play a snippet of that.
It was so long ago.
you mimeographed 16,000 copies of Sukiyaki for a major Chicago rock
I don't believe you remembered that
well,
story.
Well, I read it somewhere. But tell me, that leads to another question, but tell me what you did at Capitol Records. Is that, they have a thing here in Chicago, or were you in
it was, I was at 1326 South Michigan, because that strip between Roosevelt Road and Cermak was Record Row in the 50s. And by the time I started in 62, it was still in there. VJ was at 1449, Chess at 2120, and we were at 1326. And I worked in the promotion department, although they had no idea. They thought they needed a secretary. They wouldn't have known how to dictate a letter if their lives depended on it. This was the record industry when it was absolutely by the seat of the pants. I mean, there was no rhyme or reason. The first day I went to work there, there was no pen, no typewriter, no desk. I asked my boss, the promo guy, LP promo guy, what I should do. And he said, well, why don't you go over to that file cabinet over there and clean it out and throw out the stuff we don't need? I said, I've been here 3 minutes. Do I know what we don't need? He said, oh, just look at it. So this, just hold it up. So this music-obsessed young person, I was 22 at the time, pulls open a drawer, and it's packed from front to back with 8x10 candids of every famous musician who recorded for Capitol at the time, Sinatra and Dean Martin and Nat King Cole and Stan Kenton and Nancy Wilson. And I remember this distinctly. I remember thinking, are they going to pay me to do this? Is
and
this?
And you throw them all away? Is that the stir?
I don't have a one. I mean, I threw away what we didn't need. What
but
he
back
told
to that
me
song,
we didn't
why
need.
Were you mimeographing the lyrics? Where were those going out to? Were they just going out to listeners? Do you remember?
Well, remember old WLS?
Yeah.
Maury Lathauer, who was LP promo guy, walked up to me, walked into the office one day, and he said, oh, we're going to do a promotion with LS. I said, okay, what are we going to do? Well, we told him if anybody wrote in for the lyrics to Sukiyaki, we'd send him a translation. I said, you have to be kidding me. LS was 50, just like GN, yeah. 50,000 watt clear channel. We got, and at that time, there was no Xeroxing. It was a mimeograph machine. You got 75 copies. Every time you changed the 75 copies, you had to type another master.
So what did you learn from there that you were able to apply in the record store business?
Well, I think more than anything, I mean, I made some connections, but more than anything, it was about the music itself and about the people. My connection was to be able to talk to people about music, and that was fun to do. And I had this wide-ranging taste that was my goal was to be in size about the size of their bathroom, but a sort of reflection of Rose Records in Chicago in those days, which I thought was just the pinnacle of what a record store could be. And I would have barely fit in their bathroom. I mean, that's...
Well, they were the biggest record store in the world.
They were the biggest record store in the world, and they were just this phenomenal place. But it was... I mean, retail is very different. It's not within the insides of the industry in the same way, but it's all connected, and it's the same. There's a sort of mentality to the industry, and people have circulated around it, went from retail to major labels to indies to promotion to, you know, it's all connected.
Very few people get rich, but you know, you just love the music. You know, there's a small handful, but you just there's no, you know, you just drink it, you breathe it, you live it. You know, you just, if you can find any way to suck on the teat of music, you know, whether you're a bar back in a club, or you know, working the racks at a record store, and these jobs are shrinking. You know, unfortunately.
Yeah. Or as Paul Natkin, I'm sure, talked about, you know, the only reason he became a photographer is that he could get into the shows for free.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple minutes, so just each of you give me the details again on Record Store Day at your place. I also, you can, if you can dovetail that with what happens on the day after Record Store Day, that's when you might see me. So each of you.
And then, we do great because they don't let us sell this stuff online during Record Store Day, and we're also a website. We're a very big website. So that Sunday, everybody who couldn't get everything in their hometowns, and that includes many people around the world, order from us. So we have a giant Sunday, but that day, you know, we're out there at 6 in the morning handing coffee out, donuts. We're going to have donuts from Westtown Bakery, bagels from New York Bagels. We're going to have the empanadas food truck. We're going to have coffee from Dark Matter. We've got a magician coming to work the crowd all afternoon. He's a great guy, very funny. We have a Wheel of Fortune giving away prizes to everyone. We also have all these free gifts for the first 100 customers. You know, any kid that walks in the door, we've got pop. You know, it's just, we don't even have shows because we don't want to get in the way of giving stuff away, interacting, talking with the people, like Val's saying. That's the most important part, you know.
And your address and website again?
1120 North Ashton Avenue, open at 8 a.m. on Record Store Day.
Val.
We will open at 9. We'll have the coffee and donuts for the early birds and stuff. Music will start about 9. The guys who are founders of Funkadaisy, Lloyd Broadnax King, and Paul Mertens is going to sit in on some stuff, Poi Dog Pondering people, and the guys from Tributosaurus did this show 2 years ago and played for 7.5 hours. So I have no idea what Lloyd's going to do. I'm turning the stage over to him. We can't even mess with it. So we'll have music all day. Everything in the store will be on sale. We'll get our donuts from the Buzz Cafe, which is our home, our home diner right around the corner. So it'll be a lot of fun. And as far as the business is concerned, mostly what happens on Sunday for us is, it's not a huge day for us, but it's a lot of people going, oh, I thought that was next week. Oh, no, don't you have that Rolling Stones? Do you have any left? You know, so that's what we face on Sunday.
Well, thanks. We'll be back with Nocturnal Journey after this.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere.
it's time to head out on the road and grab a slice of Americana. It's the Nocturnal Journey on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal, and we're on the road to one of my favorite Route 66 towns in the state of Illinois. That would be Litchfield. And we've got Tom Emery, author, historian from Carlinville. Thanks for joining us tonight, Tom.
How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing okay. And I think in December, I was at the Super 8 there in Litchfield, and I picked up some local newspapers, and I saw the Buzz, the Prairie Land Buzz, and I saw a great article you wrote. I told you the other day on the phone, it was great. Your phone number was at the end of the article. But tell us about this article. Just fascinated me, about the Plopper Homestead in Litchfield. And I've got a lot of questions here, so tell us what that is.
The Plopper Homestead is in a little town called Litchfield, Illinois. It's about 250 miles south of Chicago. It sits on I-55 and historic Route 66. It centers around the Plopper Laboratories. And I know it sounds kind of corny, Plopper Laboratories. Sounds like plop down on something. But the Plopper Laboratories are a very unassuming lot of buildings. If you drive by them now, you would never see anything unusual about it. But the stories they have to tell are just really, really odd. They made, among other things, in these laboratories, and they're very cracked laboratories, I might say, they made unusual medicines, things called the Easy X pill as well as the Plopper pill. And that's really where the story that the laboratories surround.
This was like in the give us a time frame. This was in the 1950s?
They started doing these in the 1940s and early 1950s, mainly the 1950s. So it's been about 60 years ago.
And according to the article that you wrote, the Plopper pill could fix any ailment, but it was made with psychoactive mushrooms and various forms of cocaine. And it talked about how certain products would come in from Mexico and they'd fly them into Litchfield. I didn't know you could fly into Litchfield. So tell me what you learned about this little thing they had going on there.
Well, they're actually well located because there's a small airport just literally down the street from the Plopper Laboratory. So I guess they bring the people in from Mexico, bring them in very quietly, smuggle them down to the laboratories, and get what they needed. The laboratories, when we talk about laboratories, this is not some fancy building or anything scientific. A lot of these are small one-story buildings, including a small metal shed that had an inordinate amount of electrical power coming out. It's about the size of a garage. And, Dave, I think you've seen the photo of it, and it's it just has a ridiculous number of power lines and transformers coming in and out of it. This Plopper pill, you could only buy on site. You could buy them two at a time. The family patriarch, Herbert Plopper, wouldn't let them be sold anywhere else. We don't know exactly what went into those things. We've heard psychoactive mushrooms, various forms of cocaine, chicken feed, among other things. But the people that took those swore they were good for anything.
It's and were they busted in March 1952? What happened? Were they kind of, someone found out about this?
Yeah,
were they closed down, or what happened?
Yeah, the feds were on Herbert's case for quite a while. On February 12th, 1952, two female undercover investigators went to the Plopper Laboratories. One claimed to have stomach cancer, and the other claimed to have arthritis. Well, obviously, Herbert had something for them, the Plopper pill, because he said it would cure anything, and that's a quote. Well, they did some investigations and found that there was nothing in that. So he was arrested on March 18th of that year, and a year-long trial ensued that actually made the papers as far away as North Carolina. It was not a local thing. By an 8-4 hung jury, he got off. But among other things, the subsequent analysis said that the pills contained, that, and I'm quoting, the dust of a substance similar to chick feed supplement. So what was going in that, I don't know. If it was just a psychological thing, people thought they were getting better or what, I don't know. But Herbert got busted.
Now, I saw this article in December. Has anything happened there since then? I mean, I read in your article, I think they were trying to make it a tourist attraction now, a massage therapy and wellness spa, which is pretty good, good segue.
Literally, an entrepreneur named Ron Bloom, it's spelled B-L-O-M, pronounced Bloom, owns that property. He's been working hard to develop a arts and history, historical cultural center there for some place to interpret Litchfield history, area history, as well as the history of the Plopper site. He's operated a number of businesses in the buildings in the several years since. He wants to develop something that would become a tourist attraction of Litchfield, because certainly the Plopper story is one of a kind.
And before we wrap it up, there's other things to do in Litchfield. I mean, what's going on at the Ariston? Is the drive-in move? I really do love Litchfield. It's just a great place to stop when you're doing 66. What are some of the other things going on there on 66?
The Ariston Cafe is probably the biggest local landmark. That was actually found in my hometown, Carlinville.
Right.
1924. It's been a Litchfield landmark, I think, since 1929.
That's for sale now, isn't it?
It is. It's for sale. And I'm sure people are worried about that. I don't see that one going anywhere because that's a popular place, not just that area, but the Midwest. You actually have a classic drive-in theater that sits on 66 in Litchfield. So you have Lake Lou Yeager, which is one of the finest lakes in downstate Illinois. So there's several things going on in Litchfield, and Ron wants to add to the story of Litchfield with this plopper site.
Is there a timetable for that or anything? For the
He's hoping to have this massage and wellness spa, which will kind of house a smaller cultural center. He's hoping to have that open this summer. He's hoping for a larger cultural center as funding comes available, but he's hoping to have something in place at least to get started by the summer.
That cracks me up that they have a wellness spa on the side of this laboratory.
Yeah, can you imagine something like that? Yeah, I wonder what Herb would say about that.
Well, thanks. What else are you working on? Tell me some of the other books you've got coming out before we let you go.
Before Christmas, I released a full-length book on the Civil War in Illinois, which tells the story of, we have such a rich Civil War history here in Illinois, and certainly Chicago was a big part of that. And in my book, I talk a lot about Chicago's contributions to the war. That one's went over very well for me. I'm also working on a large book on the major Civil War battles in Missouri. But my research interests the Civil War, and I also speak around, offer speaking engagements around the state. I've been in Cook County several times on speaking engagements, mainly on the Civil War. But my new Civil War in Illinois book has been a really good one for me.
Do you have a website or anything?
People can email me, which is my name, which is TomEmery42@yahoo.com.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight. Tell us about Route 66 down in Litchfield, and good luck. Keep in touch about that spa. I'll come down there for the grand opening.
Hey, thanks, Dave. I appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to be back with some live music after this, so don't go away from Nocturnal Journal. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN 720, and that was Vivian Garcia, and we're talking about your guys' show. We have Vivian Garcia, Anna Soltis, and Amy Soraya, and you have a show coming up at the Double Door on April 12th, right?
Do I have that right? That is correct.
And what time is that show?
7:30. The doors open. 8 o'clock, we go on.
Right.
And tell me what people can expect. I mean, you're all singer-songwriters. I've got some more specific questions, but how'd you all meet, and what can people expect at this show?
Well, Anna and I met on a boat. We met on a yacht, actually, 2 years ago, a little yacht party. We were both commissioned to play a show for some really cool people, the Get Off the Couch people. Mm. And I met her and fell in love with her voice. And then, for me anyway, Anna does a lot of trunk shows at her house. And then I saw Amy Soraya play. And I fell in love and wanted to perform with both of these ladies ever since.
Yeah, it's been a love story, really.
Yeah, it's really. Yeah.
And what of all have you learned from each other and stuff?
Well, I've known Anna for what? Mm-hmm. Since 2006. And we've actually learned a lot from each other. We wrote a song together.
That's how we met you.
Yeah, right.
We wrote a song called Sweet Chariot, and it was about the day laborer's struggle a few years ago, and it's been amazing. We perform songs together, we sing together, and and when Vivian called us up and asked us to do the show, we were just so excited because they're just, you know, both really amazing Chicago artists, and we all have a different sound, I think. You know, I play some accordion, kind of cabaret style music, you know, with harmonies. Vivian plays more of a Latin style of music. And Anna's got a soulful, sultry sound. So I think,
and she sings in French. Oh, it's so sexy.
That's right.
It's
yeah.
So sexy. Thanks, ladies. So that's why we love each other. We talk each other up. So
that's
nice.
Right. Exactly.
Well, one reason I wanted to bring you all together, I think the immigration story, I mean, when we did the story on the Sweet Chariot and stuff, but you each bring such a distinct background to what you do. Now, I don't know you, Vivian, but you're parents are Cuban?
Yes, my parents were from Cuba, but I was raised here in Chicago and spent 3 years living in Spain, actually, not too long ago. Right. So I was actually an immigrant there. That was an interesting experience.
And Anna, Poland and Paris before Chicago?
Poland, Paris to Chicago. So I was, you know, really felt what it's like to be an immigrant here in this country. Yeah, it was 1990s. It was quite a long time ago, but as a young person, yeah.
And Amy, India?
And I was born here in Chicago, but my parents are from India, and they were immigrants. So, yeah, I guess we've all shared an immigrant experience.
Mm-hmm. So root music, the music of your heritage and stuff, do you bring that into it? Will people be able to hear that? Do they hear that in your
music?
You
know, a lot of people tell me they do hear a little bit of that. And I'm not sure I'm going to do it that night, but I do a Bollywood cover song, which is kind of fun.
Beautiful.
What's that? Which one do you do?
It's called Intaha Ho Gayi, and it's from a 1979 Bollywood film called Sharabi. And it's interesting because they try to emulate more of a Western style. It's like kind of almost a spaghetti Western. And then, you know, we're taking an Indian, you know, trying to emulate something more Indian. So, you know, I guess it's kind of a combination of what I am, you know, American and Indian together. So it's a great song.
Same question for you, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think when I first moved to the States, I was really obsessed with traditional American music. And that was the first time that I really started hearing it was when I came here and I started listening to 104.3 Dick Biondi.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
What was his name?
Is he still on?
He's great, yeah. Yeah. I loved it.
So anyways, I didn't speak any English, you know, but it was really moving to me coming to this country when, you know, New Kids on the Block was really famous and realizing that I had nothing in common with people my age in that way and that station really... One, it was really easy to understand the messages in that music because they're like mantras of really powerful messages that were really beautiful and resonated really well with me, and I understood. But also the melodies and the whole thing really kind of. So it was more me learning about the American songwriting, traditional songwriting, you know, format, and then. But I sing in French sometimes.
Yeah. And Vivian.
You know, it's interesting. My parents were Cuban immigrants, but there was a focus on assimilating when I was a young woman. So I didn't grow up speaking Spanish. I learned it in college. And later, when I picked up the guitar, because I didn't pick it up until I was 24, I did start to learn Latin American rhythms and then some flamenco stuff. And so, you know, ultimately, the type of flamenco that I do, rumba flamenco, is a fusion of Cuban rhythms and Spanish and Eastern kind of chord progressions, which I won't necessarily do tonight. But so there is a little bit of that in there. I just think growing up on the north side of the city, I was exposed to house music and freestyle, and 150 languages were spoken in the neighborhoods that I lived in and did community work in. So I feel like it's my cultural heritage. All kinds of music are my cultural heritage. So all of those are inflected in the things that I do, I think.
Mm-hmm. I've asked each of you to maybe play a song, so you're each going to do one. So
yeah.
I'll open it up, whoever wants to do the first one, and I might have a question for that before the 10:30 news.
You want to start?
I'll start, why not?
This is called Mache, so there's a little French in here.
I still dream in color when you're out. Breathe in the smiles of your melodic sounds. I've sat in the pools of golden lights, eyes wide open as clear as night. Chewing on the roses to clean the air tonight. You've seen me drowning on my own breath. Watch me struggle as I help out the rest. held my head under waters far way too long. Pulled the teeth from my head just to show me you're strong. Chewing on the roses to clean the air tonight. The seasons you've been around, held your hand as we travel through sound. Let's follow the stars to a resting place. Take a breath and forget all the rest. Chewing on the roses to clean the air tonight. Et encore, moi je rêve à les roses pour nettoyer l'air. Et j'espère que peut-être ça veut faire quelque chose. Et encore, moi je rêve à cette rose pour nettoyer l'air. Et j'espère que peut-être ça veut faire quelque chose. Marcher à les roses pour nettoyer l'air ce soir. Marcher à les roses pour nettoyer l'air ce soir.
Wonderful, Anna Soltis.
Thank you.
Here at the Allstate Cabaret. Well, what was that for all the people outside? What would translate what you were singing there?
Chewing on the Roses. I was just repeating that in French. But it's a song I wrote about a relationship. And this one time there was this event where, you know, people don't always get along and so on and so forth. And there was this big blow up. And I went to his house afterwards and his idea for a makeup story was to buy me a container of petals, of rose petals, and for me to take a bath with rose petals.
I'm writing this down.
And I found it extremely pathetic.
Yeah.
And go get your rose petals from the fridge and enjoy a bath. Yeah. So anyways, I never used the rose petals, and I threw them out and wrote that song.
Now, will you perform that at the Double Door?
I will.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're gonna take a break for the news, and we're back with some more music, so don't go away. You got a nice crowd out there.
I know.
We'll be back.
La, 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 la. Whoa, oh, yeah. Love is everything. What am I to do? Oh, when every day I walk these streets alone and I come home to a cold bed too. La 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 la. Oh, 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 oh. Yeah, 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 yeah. say, don't worry, girl, it's gonna happen when you ain't looking. Well, it's been 3 years now, and I tell you, I ain't seen a thing.
Very good, Vivian Garcia.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Now that's cold bed. I know
yes.
that. Yeah.
yes. And, yeah. A little repetitive.
Then, I actually had heard that one. So tell me a little bit about that song and where it came.
So I was living in Madrid. I went to study to do a master's degree. And, you know, I just turned 40. I was there in my late 30s and I didn't know anybody there. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great and exciting to live abroad. And then I was like, oh, my God, this is great and lonely. And I would walk the streets often in the parks, and I would take my guitar to a lot of the plazas and parks in Madrid. And, you know, that song surfaced there, and it ended up being the reason I wrote an album in English while living in Spain.
You know, what I'm hearing like this ambiance and the sound around your music, and for all you guys, do you write from a sound or an ambiance, or do you write from words, or where does the final product come from? Is it a combination of both? I mean, it's very worldly to off the top of my head.
I think it's a combination. Well, for me, it's a combination of both. I usually start with the music and then improvise lyrically, and, you know, the words just start to come, and they seem to fit the sound. And a lot of times it comes from heartbreak. Sometimes it comes from something more positive, but
very like once rarely. In a while.
I mean, the two songs we've heard tonight, I mean, I really feel a sense of place in each of the songs, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think I'm not at all classically trained in guitar or music. I mean, I did some piano when I was younger or whatever, but I really found an outlet vocally. So, like, melodies and the idea of enunciation and how words, you know, what effect words can have in the flow of them and the longevity of each word and how it, you know, so it really, for me, it's like melody. But yes, you know, sometimes it's music first, a few chords here, and then words. And it's just, there's no way to, like, there's no formula.
Yeah,
you know,
it's honestly, when I wrote this song, people are like, oh, that sounds like French chanson. I'm like, it does.
It does.
Awesome, yeah. Thanks. Yeah. But, you know, I was living in Europe, and I was around a lot of people from different countries and going to open mic. So I do feel like a little bit of that bled into what I was doing. But certainly, sometimes it is melodically driven. Sometimes it's rhythm. Sometimes it's thematic. But, I don't really have an exact process.
I really liked, if I can talk a little bit about the David Bowie show over at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And that was, like, a really cool thing. Because obviously in the beginning, inspiration just comes from wherever, right? I mean, you're living stuff. Things are just coming to you. You're like, you know, you feel brilliant, right? Like you're making sense of everything. But there, you know, you get those days and you get those months and you get those years sometimes where just nothing comes. And I really liked that little machine that David Bowie had where he, well, at first it started out with paper and he would just take words and then place them on the table and shuffle them up and then just get inspired by just random sentences. And then he had a machine that would like randomize the words. But, you know, it, I guess that's kind of what's happening almost in your brain. And then you're trying to piece it all together, I guess, and try to make a story out of it just to keep it interesting. I just really like that machine.
It was cool. Do people, I mean, how do you book shows? I mean, do people put you in a folk, I mean, folk or singer-songwriter? What's it like to get live gigs in this town?
Wow, that's a protracted conversation.
Yeah.
That's another random machine.
Yeah, isn't it? I know for me particularly, I do rumba flamenco stuff, so I do like Gypsy Kings. I can do like the restaurant circuit. I sing with an Afrobeat Latin band called SO, Afrojam Funk Beat, and we do the nightclub scene. And then just because I just started as a singer-songwriter 2 years ago and I met these amazing women, I have entree into the singer-songwriter. So for me, it's kind of, it just depends on who's looking for what. But I do try and mold myself to different situations.
Yeah, and there's a great community in the city. You know, I think for us, we're really excited about the show because it's three women that happen to be friends, you know, and I think there's a camaraderie there that's really unique and beautiful, and we're excited for that energy, you know, and having all three of our bands playing together. But in the Chicago is a lot of really, really amazing musicians, and we sort of tend to look out for each other, or try to, and if, you know, if somebody thinks that you know, someone coming through town is a good fit for you, they will recommend you, and then next thing you know, you're getting emails about a cool show that's
what
coming
about,
up.
Amy does a lot of amazing shows. So,
well, yeah, it's a lot. You know, once you get your foot in the door, I feel like it's the venues are more likely to book you, and it is somewhat proving yourself. They want you to bring a crowd, so if they know you're going to bring a crowd, you know, they're much more likely to book you and know that you're going to book other great artists as well. And you know,
I mean, in L.A., you hear these stories. I don't know if it's hit Chicago yet about pay-to-play and stuff
like
that.
Yeah.
I'll never do that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, you know,
insane.
We were talking about that the other day.
About the
just the payouts are really silly. I mean, you walk out of a bar having paid more money most of the time. Well, or some
for
of the time.
Drink.
Just for being there than you do actually making money. And you've now just attracted all these people to come into the bar. And you are paying to play.
Yeah.
And
artists are not valued, unfortunately. And I don't know, not to say that myself, but all artists, I mean, we bring so much to people's lives. And I think it's really sad when you can't even make $10 from a show. Sometimes you walk away, it was a crowded show, and, you know, we got $25 for the whole band.
Yeah.
Like, seriously?
Yeah,
that's
a joke. And then you don't even get free beer.
Yeah, because they'll take that out of your pay. Yeah. That's why we gave you a case of PBR. So.
Yeah. It's called hospitality, and it's like $50 or something.
But you guys will be April, I want to keep plugging it, April 12th at the Double Door, 1572 North Milwaukee.
Yes, and it's actually door three, we're in the downstairs room at the Double Door, which is so warm and beautiful and such a nice place to hear music. The sound guy is amazing down there. I mean, the whole venue
is
great. But
and there is limited capacity, though, and a lot of people said they're coming, so buy your tickets.
Wow.
Yeah. And are you? Did I hear you say you have bands, or are you playing solo?
Yeah, no, all bands.
Mm-hmm. All bands. Okay. And so you're going to play a song?
I am going to play a song. Okay. I've got an accordion here, so I hope I don't blow out the microphone.
Into my precious inside.
Amy Soraya, razor blade, right?
Razor blade sharp.
I'm feeling a little outnumbered, Dan Long.
Oh, gosh, so, I know. Another jaded, angry love song. Not so anti-man, is it?
Yeah, first of all, tell me about the history of that instrument. Does the accordion, I mean, how long have you had it?
Well, I grew up playing the piano since okay. I was five. And then, and I played guitar, I had bands, and then my brother-in-law, who is German, grew up in Minnesota, brought home his aunt's accordion to our place. And I picked it up and I was like, wow, this is an amazing, beautiful instrument. It's like a symphony in your hands, you know, kind of thing. And I instantly fell in love and started writing songs on it right away. And so,
again, it goes back to the craft. I keep asking these questions about the craft of songwriting. So, again, does a song find that instrument, or did you apply that into, you know, apply the instrument into that song?
Has it... The instrument is what made that song. I mean, you know, just the sound of it with this, and that's why it reminded me of a razor blade. You know, that so I was like, oh, okay, it sounds like a razor blade, and yeah, and then my. One of my bandmates had just had this terrible breakup, and she was so heartbroken. And so I wrote that song kind of to, you know, talk about what she went through, and hopefully it was cathartic for her. So I don't know.
I was going to just say that Amy has an amazing music video for that song.
We actually put out a video for that.
Sexy burlesque, but cutting edge.
Yes. It's a great video, awesome. And we were very lucky to work with Logan Hall, who created that. So...
what's it like, I mean, to go through the band experience? I mean, I was just doing some research. I didn't know about this band. This is way back for you, but Radiant Darling.
Radiant Darling. I mean, a lot of the songwriting style is very similar to what I did in Radiant Darling. And, you know, now we've got, like, two backup singers. So the harmonies I used to do on my own, I've got, you know, two other ladies helping me out on. And the accordion wasn't on Radiant Darling. That's kind of a Amy Soraya and the Outcome thing, but... yeah, and before that, I was in a lot of R&B bands, and so, yeah. So this has really kind of become kind of what I've chiseled away at and the kind of sound that we're that I'm going for. So, yeah.
Same question for you, the band experience and a solo artist.
Yeah, I never thought I was going to be a musician. I went to school for painting, and I went to
an amazing painter.
And I, yeah. Thanks, ladies. And I do I do public art for a living with a nonprofit in Chicago called Green Star Movement. But about God, I guess like 7-ish years ago, I started writing poetry more seriously, and I had asked my mom for a guitar, and she bought me an Esteban. And my fingers still hurt from that guitar. but yeah, and I just started, you know, messing around. And based on the, inspiration of these kind of really folk-rooted artists that played, you know, three-chord wonders, I was like, if they can do it, I can do it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how it started, you know, for me.
Vivian, did you say you didn't start till you were 24?
Yeah, I started. All my degrees are in literature, so I didn't study music either, though I did go live in southern Spain for a total of 6 months to study flamenco guitar in the caves of Spain. But, yeah, many years ago, I worked with some people, and I sang. I just sang. I fronted bands. I've been doing it for, like, 16 years now, and I did Spanish ballads and some rumba flamenco, but it was only about 7 or 8 years ago that I really worked on becoming a solo artist and have then since incorporated other people playing with me. And now a decade later, I am in a band once more. But I really kind of function in that band just as a singer as well, although they want me to play guitar, but I don't play all crazy, funky Afrobeat. So, but when I do my shows, some of those same really talented musicians come on board and play saxophone and trumpet and lead guitar with me. And Amy joined me on my last show at Martyrs a couple of weeks back and played accordion on a track. So that was fun.
That was awesome.
Literature, you're a fan of Neruda?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm going back to Spain to finish, hopefully, my MA in Spanish and Latin American.
I've seen his homes in Chile. They're really awesome.
Wow.
They're really,
lucky you.
They're really nice. Can we talk? We got about 3 or 4 minutes. Can we talk about how we met? We started the segment with that. Maybe you could play a little bit of a Sweet Chariot. And when I'm interested in that story, I remember you guys telling me when I did that story about how you actually went and interviewed some of these immigrant workers and stuff. And I mean, you did like a journalism type thing to get put the song together.
It was through the Latino Union, actually, and it was Dave Meyer.
Right.
Dave Myers who asked us, he's like, hey, you know, I really love your style. Can you and Anna write a song together? Yeah. And, you know, we got to meet, it was like on the corner of Belmont.
Yeah, we should say where it's at. I don't know if they're still there. Belmont and Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
And what we should say, set it up. I mean, from 6 a.m., when I did the story, 6 a.m. to 4 p.m., 7 days a week, they wait for day jobs.
Yeah, right? It's very sad seeing people wait for hours, sometimes 7 to 8 hours in the cold when it's hot. They don't always get jobs. And when they do get jobs, they're not sure they're necessarily going to get paid or if they're hurt on the job, if there's any, you know.
Yeah, and that was like a huge proponent of it. Is like the Latino Union has created a safe haven for the day laborers in Chicago, but it is a nationwide outreach, and the idea is that there is some kind of protection in place for day laborers that put their lives and their bodies and all this in jeopardy every day.
Right, almost like a union where they're signing contracts with these employers, hopefully, that will, protect them.
Yeah. And the idea of the song was just to get some, artistic awareness, out and just to have something to become sort of a staple that represented these people without it just, with an empowering piece versus just something that is sad, because there is a lot of beauty that can come out of an organization like that helps people, because everyone needs help. You know, someone needs their bathroom painted or whatever, that's fine, but let's protect the people that are doing it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the story and I really love this song. That's why I asked you to play it. So, yeah, we got it. So can you? Sweet Chariot?
Yep.
Hop aboard the pickup truck. Sweep a spot for the workman's luck. You might get your chances with me. But you like to cry and try to pretend that you don't rely on my strength to win. How far can you walk without me? Swing low, sweet chariot. Will you ever
Your company's the backbreak bones, bulldoze my livelihood back home, but you won't make no room for me. And I'll stand the heat and I'll stand the cold, and I'll wait in swarms when my kids grow old. I've known what it's like to be free. Swing low, sweet chariot, will you ever welcome me home? I knelt with both my hands behind my back. I held my breath, but I won't ticket to the promised land, pies in the sky for the working man, and day by day you crush my plans. Take the time to get to see the man I am, the warrior in me, and together we can both shake hands. Swing low, sweet chariot, will you ever welcome me home? I knelt with both my hands behind my back. I held my breath, but I won't drive. Thank
you very much, Amy Soraya and Anna Soltis for Sweet Chariot. And thanks, Vivian Garcia, for coming in. You guys will be April 12th.
April 12th. Doors open 7:30.
Double door. Buy tickets now. It's going to sell out.
It is. And Dave, thanks so much for having us.
Thanks. It was a big hit. We need more women on this show. We got lots of stuff. So thank you all for listening to Nocturnal Journal. Check out the Nocturnal Journal Facebook page. I'm such a bad self-promoter. Thanks to Dan Long. Aubrey Mumpower will be back on the 18th of April.